Next cases are 04-524 and 04-525, Jose Rosette versus, and Tracy Pyro versus Countywide Home Loans, Napa City Bank. Mr. Parati.
Good morning, Your Honor. Good morning, members of the court. My name is Pat Parati with DeWorkin and Bernstein on behalf of the plaintiffs' appellants, and I'd like to reserve 5 minutes. Thank you. So the General Assembly enacts a statute for civil recovery. Does it have the right to choose whether it is enacting a statute to provide damages recovery and not a recovery for penalty or forfeiture? And when may a court decide that the choice that the legislature made was not in fact its true intent? And what test do you use to reach that conclusion? The case that we have today involves a statute dealing with mortgage releases. Now, there's been a number of cases and a number of statutes in which the Ohio General Assembly has enacted recovery for penalties and forfeitures. One of those cases is what gave rise to some of the problems that we see in lower courts' decisions. For example, in Lynch versus Dial Finance, there was a statute in which the General Assembly said no less than three times that there shall be a forfeiture of certain amounts of money if certain things were done by the defendant. As a result of that, the Lynch case said, this is clearly a statute for penalty or forfeiture, so it's subject to a 1-year statute of limitations. That's an obvious and clear outcome. In this case, however, the General Assembly said exactly the opposite. Knowing how to enact a statute for forfeiture or penalty, instead it didn't say that. It said that if there is a noncompliance with this statute, that the mortgagor shall be entitled to recover in a civil action a certain amount of money in damages. Those are the words that were selected by the legislature, not by us, and those were the words that the legislature used in comparison to statutes in which it specifically used words penalty or forfeiture. So the first question is there a circumstance here where the legislature's designation of the relief should be overcome or should be ignored? We don't believe that there is. The reason for that is that our opposing counsel argues that you have to look at the substance and not the form. Since some of the discussions which were originally broached by Justice Resnick in Cosgrove and then taken by this court in Rice, there has been a recognition, contrary to some of the statutes that our opposing counsel refers to. For example, they refer to statutes in support of their position from Kansas from 1889, from Connecticut from 1888, from Alabama from 1938. They refer to a number of old statutes that talk about the idea of penalty or forfeiture versus remedy. And they say, based on those statutes and those cases, this should be determined to be a penalty. However, this court, when it talked in Cosgrove, and this court, when it talked in Rice, said, the modern view is that where a statute is enacted of this type, it serves a dual purpose. It both serves a punitive purpose for the concept of public right in order to make a compliance with the statute a reality. And it also serves a remedial purpose in order to protect the public and to protect the individuals to whom a remedy is given. Based on that, the court then said, how do we deal with the question of if there's a dual purpose, which one is treated as primary? The way the court deals with that, according to this court in Cosgrove and this court in Rice, is you use a test that was used by the United States Supreme Court in Huntington versus Atrill. And that test is a good test. Our opposing counsel say, no, that's not a good test for a number of reasons. First of all, it's a test that only applies to the concept of full faith and credit or federalism. That's not true. The doctrine of Huntington has been applied, and we've cited them in our brief, repeatedly to cases involving statutes of limitations. Englander in the Sixth Circuit, the United States Court of Appeals, Brady in the United States Supreme Court, the Supreme Court of Oklahoma in Sudbury, the Minnesota Supreme Court in 1991 in McDaniel, the United States Ninth Circuit in Stone in 1995. All of those cases have dealt with, and there's others, have dealt with the concept of Huntington analysis for purposes of defining whether a statute is remedial or penal for purposes of what limitation period applies. Now, in this case, we have a statute, and really the primary argument by my opposing counsel is one thing. If a statute allows any recovery in excess of actual damages, it is a penalty. Period. End of story. No more test. That's not realistic, because if that is the case, then this court's pronouncements in Rice, this court's pronouncement in 1992 in Floyd, the United States Supreme Court's pronouncements in Brady, the Sixth Circuit's pronouncement in Englander applying Ohio law, those are all wrong. Because every one of those cases say expressly and specifically the opposite. They say that the fact that a statute allows recovery in excess of actual damages does not make it a penalty. Rather, what you have to do is you have to look at how the statute achieves its results. And when you use the Huntington test here, you look at three things. You look at, number one, primarily, does the statute redress a public or private wrong? Now, in this case, we're dealing not with a state wrong. We're dealing with a contractual obligation of two private parties. We're dealing with harm to the individual. This court, and that's another one of their mantras, is these people aren't harmed. That's what the legislature looked at here. As this court stated in Pinchot, which was handled by my co-counsel here, Mr. Rochelle, these people are harmed. The non-recording of a release when a mortgage has been paid off specifically clouds the title of the property and creates a harm and injustice to the property owner. If you have a property and you paid off your mortgage, let's say you want to refinance, you can't refinance that house if the new lender looks and the title company says, that mortgage for $100,000 is still there. We're not going to insure through that. When the credit bureau looks and you say, I want to take out a home equity loan or I want to take out a credit card loan, they look and they say, well, geez, you haven't paid off your mortgage for $100,000. You say, yes, I have.
The problem with your argument is that there are many, many mortgagees here who may never have had anybody look at their credit for the period of time that the lien was still on it and had no actual damages at all, cloud on the title in and of itself without anybody doing anything about it, anybody trying to apply for credit, doesn't mean anything. It just is simply on the books. So this is something that is assessed even if somebody has total inability to prove damages, is it not?
No. This is a situation in which the General Assembly said, if you have the circumstance that you indicated, Your Honor, that the individual can come forward and they can adduce additional evidence to say, it's not just $250 for me here, I lost a mortgage, and based on the variable points that I now have to pay.
You're taking the argument upwards, I'm taking it downwards. If they can come forward, but they cannot even prove $250 in damages, they still get $250, do they not?
They get $250 because the legislature determined, and again, that's a very important question, because the court has to decide, does the legislature have the right here to make a determination based on these types of considerations that there is a presumed harm? And yes, the legislature presumed that there is a presumed harm for which you automatically would recover $250.
So you can consider it either a presumed harm or you can consider it a penalty.
You would have a hard time presuming it as a penalty when the legislature called it damages. And our only point is because
I don't have that problem, because damages is used very interchangeably in a lot of our law. So we have to look at what was the purpose of the legislature, not just what is the term that they used. What was their purpose?
I agree. And when you look at the purpose and you look at, for example, this court's dissertations on damages, you look at the discussions when this court talked about it in, I think it was the Cosgrove case, this court talked about the idea that damages is an interference with a protected right. It is a violation of a incursion into a protected area. So is this damages or is it a penalty? When there's circumstances, for example, you have a statute in Ohio that we cited in our brief, and it was the Franklin County Court of Appeals, and it's a statute that says that if an individual is wrongfully imprisoned, even if they don't prove anything, they have a right to go into court and they automatically get $25,000 for having been wrongfully imprisoned, plus anything additional they can establish. If this court says that these types of statutes cannot prevail, and that and the Franklin County Court said that is not a penal statute, it's a remedial statute. If this court says that that's not the rule, then you would be reversing cases since Floyd, since 1942 in this state, and you would be upturning the reliance that every one of the federal courts that have addressed this question has done in applying Ohio law. Because this isn't a case, Your Honor, where you have $25,000 that says, you have $250. That's certainly not disproportionate. That's certainly not excessive or extreme. That's modest. And we believe, with due respect, that the legislature does have the right to say that based on our findings, that we can conclude that this act by itself causes a harm, which is difficult to prove, and therefore we will allow an automatic $250 plus anything else you can establish.
Counsel, how does our decision on whether this is damages or penalty and the variance within the statute of limitations, which is the ultimate concern here, how does that impact on the provisions you just mentioned for wrongful imprisonment? I'm a little confused on the link here.
Because that case in Franklin County, for example, had to make a determination of whether that kind of a statute where there's an automatic amount of recovery based on the General Assembly presuming a loss plus the right to recover actual harm, whether that is a penalty statute or a remedial statute. That's the issue here. Is this penalty or remedial? And they held that it is remedial and not penal, and that the General Assembly has the right to make that kind of a conclusion. My opposing counsel, and I see my 5 minutes would be coming up, but my opposing counsel says any statute that allows recovery in excess of actual damages is and must be considered a penalty as a matter of law. That's wrong. That's not the law in Ohio, and it shouldn't be the law in Ohio. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Prati. Mr. Chilton.
Thank you. Good afternoon, or morning. It's still morning. Your Honors, my name is Jan Chilton. I'm appearing on behalf of Countrywide Home Loans in the first of the two cases, counsel for National City Bank in the second of the two cases has very kindly ceded his time to me. The question in this case is one of statutory construction. What did the General Assembly mean when it said, in section 2305.11a, that a one-year statute of limitations applies to an action upon a statute for a penalty or forfeiture? Now, plaintiffs offer you two conflicting answers to that question. One I would deem the plain language approach, and the other the Huntington versus Atrol approach, and both of them are incorrect. Both take a blinkered approach to the question, and both ignore the historical evidence of what the General Assembly actually meant when it used the phrase statute for penalty or forfeiture. The true intent of the General Assembly must be gleaned from all of the evidence available to the court, not just little pieces and snatches which the plaintiffs rely on. Justice may be blind, but justices shouldn't be. It's particularly appropriate to consider historical evidence in this case because the statute, 2305.11a, was enacted 150 years ago. To decide now what the General Assembly meant 150 years ago, we have to put ourselves in its place. And you can only do that by examining the historical record. Moreover, the historical record of this fact, of this statute, is absolutely undisputed. We've set it out at pages 4 through 10 of our brief. There's absolutely no contradictory evidence supplied by the plaintiffs. We've shown where this statute comes from and what it meant to the people who drafted it. Moreover, the meaning shown by history is one adopted by 26 other states, as shown at pages 30 through 47 of our brief. The 26 other states all have statutes of limitation very closely similar to 2305.11a. Many of them adopted as 2305.11a was, based on the field code promulgated by the three commissioners in New York originally, led by David Dudley Field in 1851. Furthermore, this court's own decisions back in close in time to the passage, original passage of this statute, show that it too interpreted statute for a penalty or forfeiture in the same way. And what was that way? The meaning of statute for a penalty or forfeiture evolved in response to a new set of legislation that came into being largely in the early 1800s in the United States, which sought to enlist private enforcement in a new way. Used to be, way back when in England, that the only way that crimes, true crimes, were enforced was by qui tam actions. And the original progenitor, way back when, of 2305.11a was a statute of limitations for qui tam actions. But in the 1800s, as we point out in our brief, the emphasis of the law changed, and we started seeing penalty statutes like this one, which enlisted private enforcement efforts by giving aggrieved individuals, not qui tam plaintiffs, aggrieved individuals penalties as an incentive to suit. And 2305.11a and its more immediate progenitors in the Field Code specifically were intended to address that type of legislation, of which 5301.36c is a prime example.
Counsel, subparagraph C of the statute that allows recovery here says, if the mortgagee fails to comply, the mortgagor may recover in a civil action damages of $250. This division does not preclude any other legal remedies that may be available to the mortgagor. What would those other legal remedies be?
A suit for damages, for actual compensatory damages.
Well, this says you recover damages of $250.
It does say that.
Yeah. Isn't that a suit for damages?
That is a suit for a sum, a fixed sum, $250, which is labeled damages in the statute. Now, my opponent would tell you that because the label damages was used, the legislature meant somehow that this statute of limitations would not apply.
Well, I mean, you're asking us to look back 150 years to when this statute was enacted, the statute of limitations. So presumably the legislature was aware when they enacted this that there's a statute of limitations. And it talks, one, about penalties, and it talks in another part about damages. And they chose to call this damages. I guess I would call it liquidated damages. It's an arbitrary determination or a presumption that you're damaged at least that amount.
If I may respond, yeah. Your Honor, there are two points I believe respectfully that you're wrong about. First of all, the statutes of limitations do not refer to damages. They refer to actions on a statute for a penalty or forfeiture, or actions on a statute not for a penalty or forfeiture. They do not use the word damages. Secondly, if the legislature had said liquidated damages, I might agree with you that much more specific term, liquidated damages, indicated an intent to allow a presumed amount of compensation for harm actually suffered, as opposed to a penalty, which this is.
Okay. Would it be reasonable to assume that if the legislature was really thinking about this statute of limitations?
No.
They would have said, and agree with you, they would have said $250 as a penalty. Then then we're not here having an argument.
Well, obviously, if they'd used a more definite term, Your Honor, one way or the other, we wouldn't be here arguing before you. But
so
they didn't.
The reasonable presumption might be that they weren't thinking about that statute at all when they...
I quite agree with you, and that is most likely true. They weren't thinking about statute of limitations at all. So we have to look not at the label they used, but rather at the substance of what they enacted. And that's what decisions from across the country have done in exactly the situation. We cited you the Joyce
So the correct rule, you believe, would be for the $250 one year, for the actual damages, 6 years.
Pardon me, Your Honor. Yes, unless there's some other statute of limitations that would apply to that particular cause of action. I really haven't researched that, but I would assume you're correct.
So wouldn't it be fun if this class action is suddenly amended to say, well, all these people are seeking actual damages?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Your Honor, that you bring that up, because I think it points out precisely why this is a penalty and not a damage recovery. Plaintiffs have been very careful to avoid alleging actual damage. And indeed, that was one of the bases on which we opposed class certification, was that they are inadequate representatives because they did not seek actual damages, which they were waiving for all of the class members. Here, we could not more clearly separate damage recovery, compensation for actual loss, from penalty, because the plaintiffs themselves have said all we want is the penalty we do not want. We are not seeking, we will not prove actual damage.
That's easy, but I'm wondering if where we don't end up is making this all contemplated, because, you know, class action lawyers don't go away easily.
Indeed they don't, Your Honor. But number one, that issue isn't before you. But number two, there's an easy answer for it. The suit for actual damages would not be brought under the same statute, because the statute allows $250 only. It says it does not preclude other causes of action which may arise in the law under other principles of law. And if plaintiffs wanted to bring suits under other principles of law, such as breach of contract or whatever, they could do so, and separate statutes of limitations would apply to those, as they always do when plaintiffs bring different causes of action under different legal theories. So I don't think there's any oddity in saying that an actual damage recovery would, in this particular fact situation, would be governed by a different statute of limitations.
Counsel, are there any other consequences to a mortgage company, bank, etc., other than the payment of this $250 to the individuals who once held a mortgage with them? Are there any other consequences in the regulatory scheme over these institutions?
Well,
for failure to timely record the release of or satisfaction of a mortgage?
I don't believe directly that the bank regulators, if these are banks that we're talking about, actually, to take Countrywide, Countrywide is not a bank, Your Honor. It's regulated under different statutes.
But they're regulated lending institutions.
They are.
And whether it's a bank or a mortgage company or a credit union or whatever, they're still subject to this penalty of $250 per transaction that is not completed in a timely 90-day manner, correct?
Correct.
Is there any other sanctions that are imposed upon them by the regulatory agencies, by the state, by the federal government, for not doing this?
I'm not aware of any regulation that says, you know, if you don't record satisfaction on time, your license will be yanked. But regulatory agencies do have broad powers to supervise the institutions that they regulate, and might very well require the institutions to obey local laws, such as this one, as part of their ordinary examination of those institutions. I'm not aware in this case if Countrywide has been subjected to that kind of regulatory oversight on this particular question. To turn for a moment.
Counsel, I'm coming back to think about your other answer about the other kinds of actions that one could file, which said breach of contract. Is that an implied contract?
Because no, it's an express contract, Your Honor.
Certainly the bank wouldn't put in their mortgage some provision that says if we don't record the release in a timely fashion, you have the right to sue us.
Well, Your Honor,
all kinds of damages. I doubt if that's in any mortgage.
Pardon me for interrupting, Your Honor.
No.
The standard Fannie Freddie form deed of trust or mortgage security instrument contains in paragraph 22 a provision that requires, in the case of a mortgage, the mortgagor, no, excuse me, I always get this confused, mortgagee, to record a release upon payment of the secured debt. And in the case of a deed of trust, it requires the trustee to record a reconveyance. It does not set a time limit, but obviously, as with most contractual commitments that don't have set time limits, the reasonable time limit would apply, and if it wasn't recorded within a reasonable time, it would be a breach of contract.
Okay. Can you get damages for being really ticked off at your bank when you discover the problem? Probably not, can you?
Well, I don't think the law generally allows for recovery for emotional distress in breach of contract cases, but property damage, the kind of actual damage that my opponent was arguing about, where, you know, your credit is impugned, you pay higher interest rates, any of the real economic damage would definitely be recoverable.
You had another business deal set to go, and it gets held up.
Oh, absolutely. And as a matter of fact, there are examples of that sort of recovery in California, for example, under the same situation. Pintor versus Ong is the name of the case. I'm sorry, I don't have the citation available. Let me turn for a moment. I've been sort of sidetracked on their first.
It'll be a very brief moment. Your red light is on.
I wanted to say a word about Huntington versus Atrill. There, I believe, three reasons why the court should not adopt Huntington versus Atrill, despite the very able opinion of the concurrence in Cosgrove. Huntington certainly has appropriate uses, its test does, but not in the statute of limitations context. In the first place, Huntington itself very carefully distinguished what it was deciding from the statute of limitations context because the very statute which it was construing had already been determined by the Court of Appeals of New York to be a statute for a penalty or forfeiture under exactly this language for purposes of the statute of limitations. And it had to say very carefully, we're not bound by that because we're deciding a different question as to which penalty or forfeiture may have a different meaning. We, of course, are dealing with a statute of limitations question, and the Court of Appeals decision in Merchants Bank versus Bliss, which was the case that the U.S. Supreme Court distinguished in Huntington versus Atrill, is exactly our case.
You've used your time, Mr. Chilton.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Prati, you've saved a little less than 4 minutes of your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Split statute. One statute of limitations for one part of it and one statute of limitations for another part of it. That wouldn't be an ordinary construction under Ohio law for one remedy that's provided under one statute to an individual.
Well, actually, breach of contract would be a 15-year statute of limitations, wouldn't it?
Exactly. But this situation is whether you're bringing an action under this statute for this $250 labeled by the legislature as damages. The question in Huntington is, and again, I respectfully have to disagree. I don't disagree. The Ohio opinions disagree that Huntington has been used specifically to determine statutes of limitations. It was used in Cosgrove for that purpose. It's been used in all of these cases that we cited during our primary presentation. Englander, which was the Sixth Circuit, which again used Ohio law to decide what should the statute of limitations be in a situation in which the legislature gave a recovery, in which there was a recovery under a statute of a particular amount, and recovery of any actual damages over and above that. Again, the outcome that they are asking for requires you to say that the General Assembly of Ohio cannot do that. They cannot enact, even if reasonable, a liquidated or presumed amount of damages and allow for additional recovery upon proof without labeling it a penalty. That's not ever been the law in Ohio. As a matter of fact, again, the quotes we gave, the Ohio Supreme Court has said on three different occasions that that is not the test that we follow. I respect that my opposing counsel has gone back to 1560 talking about historic evidence. What they've done is they've cited case after case after case that deal with qui tam proceedings. This is not a qui tam proceeding. A qui tam proceeding is a proceeding in which the individual does not bring the suit, the state can. It's a proceeding in which the money goes to the state. It's a proceeding in which is in the name of the state. The General Assembly didn't enact this. We were talking about using a test. Helwig that they cite from the United States Supreme Court says, if the amount recovered is so enormously in excess, it will be a penalty. Joyce says, this is a penalty, but gives no analysis. Ebert says, this is a penalty, again, gives no analysis except to say, but there's actual damages over and above that, but Ohio follows the exact opposite rule. Wells that they cite is a statute that says, shall forfeit. Prudential, shall forfeit. Walker, shall forfeit. Ortlieb, shall forfeit a sum as a fine. Universal Credit, shall pay a penalty. Nolan, shall forfeit and pay a penalty. That's not what this statute says. That's not what this statute was designed to do. The 26 other states they cite, if you look at them carefully, they don't come down the way that they say they come down. And the only truth is that they show that as history has gone forward from the 1800s and from 1560, the courts have recognized that these types of statutes have a dual purpose. And therefore, what test are you going to use to decide when the legislature does this, what purpose it serves? Huntington says you decide how the legislature reached its goal. And here, when you apply the three Huntington standards, it reached its goal by giving a cause of action solely to an individual, not the state. They admit that it reached a goal by giving the cause of action where the money goes only to the individual, not the state, and they don't contend that it's disproportionate. $250 is twice the filing fee here. The legislature has a right to presume damages and to do it as a liquidated sum and not as a penalty. And therefore, the General Assembly's determination here should be affirmed, and this court should adopt the Huntington test. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.
All right.